oil and gas industry makes $3 billion a day in pure profit.
I wouldn't want to have your job this week. You wouldn't want to have my job any week.
Every oil company has a version of Tommy. You cannot function without one.
We're pushing the chips toward the middle.
Men die. Oil companies don't.
Landman. New series now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. When you get through a week, what is the one thing you want to do besides eat pizza, sit on the sofa, throw your feet up, and veg out? That would be entertained. The golden age of TV is here. Binge watching is something we've been accustomed to, and part of what makes that narrative world go round is the sonic atmosphere that permeates your ears, lives in your DNA. Shows like Lost and Yellowstone, and now Landman. We are super excited to speak to our next guest, composer extraordinaire Andrew Lockington. Forget Jablonski, forget Tyler. If you want big sounds, you want to rock the theater and the TV screen, you're going to need Lockington in your purview, in your earphones, blasting through your Sonos speakers. Anyway, we are going to welcome this wonderfully talented young man, old man. I don't know how he fits it all in. He must be aging daily because of how much work he does. But I ramble and I will stop. So hitting pause. Andrew, thank you for being on the show. How are things in your world?
Well, Mark, that's quite the introduction. I should get you to write my bio page on IMDb. Things are good, man. How are you doing today?
Doing super. Excited to talk to you about all the work you've been doing. You've been putting in the hours, as we discussed before we hit record. You still look like you're in the land of the living. I don't know. I expected to see a ghastly phantasm, a ghost, a shell, former shell of a self, but you look healthy and vibrant. So before we get into the fun stuff, what are your Thanksgiving and holiday plans? Anything to take a break from the working grind?
So my favorite day of the year, I am Canadian. So I'm talking to you from Toronto, Canada, and therefore our Thanksgiving was almost a month ago. And so my favorite day of the year is actually American Thanksgiving, because it's the one day of the year I do not get phone calls and no one expects me to be working. So I am a Detroit Lions fan. My wife and I are going to watch the game, go for lunch, do some shopping, and just take a day off. Very excited for it.
Composers, they're just like us. So that's awesome. A lot of fun. Well, usually before we get into the meat and the potatoes, we have an appetizer, a little bit of a charcuterie. Andrew, let's go in the Wayback Machine. What about the sonic palette and the world of entertainment got you excited at a young age and set you off on this like a horse? Yeah, let's just ride into the sunset.
I took piano lessons as a kid, and I did not like the task each week of learn these three lines of Mozart or Beethoven or whatever the composer du jour was. So I would instead sit there and start, have my mind would wander, and I would just start writing and improvising my own music. When it came time to go to my piano lesson the following week, and I didn't know the stuff I was supposed to know, I would just improvise it on the spot and pretend that I was following the notes on the page. And somehow I've converted that lack of attention into a living, writing music for film. I do know that when I would do that, I was always influenced a lot by visuals. Like if I was sitting at a piano, or if I had a guitar and I was sitting by a lake, or, you know, somehow the visual influence and inspiration made the music different each time. So I think I remember very clearly looking out the window when I would sit and play piano when I was a kid and improvise and write songs and instrumental music, which I guess now I call cues in film and television. But I remember a real association. So I guess I kind of think that, you know, film and television and drama and media, music sort of feels like I'm looking out a different window each time, and that it sort of influences different kind of music for each different world I'm writing for.
Well, you mentioned improvising, and I think what is key about that is, I think with music, there are certain things that work, circle of fifths, certain major and minor chords, but at the end of the day, it's not wrong. Like I believe there's no wrong note. It's just not right for right now. I think that there's a potential for everything to have a place, whether it's disaster piece or Fotech, or anybody who has an avant-garde style, because that's what made them who they are. And I feel like by you having, you use music as a way to just get what you felt inside of you out in a way that you felt, happy and appropriate doing. So, did you meet some encouragement with that, or did you kind of get your knuckles wrapped by a ruler and a nun saying, "Nope, prim and proper on the harpsichord"?
That is funny. So I had two sort of streams once I got into high school. I wanted to be a rock star, like I think 99% of humans at that age. And I loved film scores. I had the thought of doing film scoring, and I was in a band with much older like people. It was a full-time job for them, and I was in high school. And the band kind of parted ways right around the time university applications were due. So my fallback was to go and study music at university. That's probably where I hit the biggest roadblock in terms of film music, because film music in that environment wasn't really thought of in the way it is today. I think it nowadays it's really one of the patrons of new interesting music, and where a lot of the boundaries get pushed, whereas classical music is less so, at least in my experience. So there was a little less excitement on the part of the professors I worked with in terms of going into film music or referencing John Williams or James Horner or Alexandre Desplat, any of these composers. But that said, I think, what you touched on, the whole idea of sort of just there's no wrong note. It's funny you said that, because I really feel like in the last few years I've tried to take the logical reasoning out of composing and really just turn my brain off and let the inspiration flow through it and come out without having to explain why you do this or why this sounds right or why it works. And two things have happened. One, I think the response from my collaborators has been really good. And two, I enjoy it so much more than I did. A lot of times I think you can self-edit. It's really easy to find reasons not to do something, and you can sometimes take the magic out of what was a really good idea by trying to figure out how to put into words why it makes sense. Yeah, that's a long-winded answer for a simple question, but I'm glad you mentioned it, because it is definitely something I've thought of a lot lately, and I actually try to make a conscious effort to not be conscious about what I'm doing.
You may be as long-winded as you want. Really, there is no rules, no agenda. We're just here to have some fun. But I'm glad you reciprocated the question, and with the mentality that you've adapted and learned. And the reason I bring that up is because I work in the hotel business, so I work for an architecture firm. And there's so many times that I think to myself, it's not a bad idea, and it's always great to challenge. Why do we have to do it this way? We might come up, especially young professionals, they call them emerging professionals, young designers, the idea that they don't know what they don't know, and sometimes that's actually their strength. Because if you get bogged down into, well, you're going to have a talk with the general contractor on site saying he can't do it, without X number of steel fortifications, and it's like, okay, we'll do that if that makes the design work and it makes it cool and people talk about it. French horns, the organ wah in Interstellar. I mean, these things are, things that resonate literally and physically over the years because of people taking chances. So, hell yeah, screw those naysayers.
Well, we talk a lot about it in our industry, that you actually have to take risks to do something great. And they do these test screenings of films, often in Hollywood, where they'll show it to 500 people before it's released and while it's in progress. And I always find it interesting because sometimes you end up with half the audience saying it's a 9 out of 10, and then the other half of the audience says it's a 4. And there's a lot of concern, how do we get those 4s up? But my thought is always, wow, half the people think it's a 9 out of 10. You don't want to lose those people. So I think some of the best creations, and I think this would apply to architecture as well, are things that people either absolutely love or they don't like at all. And that's kind of what makes them great, is the idea that, I would much rather do something that half the people love and half the people don't like than something everyone thinks is a 7 out of 10.
Well, I'll probably be chastised for this, but Frank Gehry, basically, the Seattle Pop Museum, the
Yeah.
Disney, Symphony. It's like it looks like a crumbled up piece of paper, but some people love it, some people hate it. But moving on, I think one of the universal way people come together is by music. And so your cup of tea might be different from my cup of tea, but we could still say we jammed and had a good time. So what were some of the, professionally speaking aside, what are some of the things that you resonate to? Is it EDM? Is it Spanish polka? Like what are the things that you find, I'm not going to say guilty pleasures, but just your personal tastes outside of your business?
Outside of my business, podcasts probably. I listen to so much music each day, and I make a conscious effort to not listen to a lot of music that isn't what I'm working on, because so much of what I do is I come up with a melody in my head, and then while I'm showering, while I'm exercising, while I'm walking, playing in the park with the dog, I'm running through all these variations in my head of what that could do. And my biggest concern is I don't want it to be infected by something I didn't write, or something that I don't want to be influenced by something someone else did necessarily, at
Sure.
least not at that stage. So yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts, to be honest, and I don't listen to a ton of music. I think I've grown to like all instruments and all kinds of music, and I think that's maybe born out of the fact that that different films require different kinds of scores, and therefore you start to learn. Like I remember, I did years ago, I did a couple of those dance films with the like the inner city dance teams kind of having the competitions, and that wasn't anything I knew or was familiar with or had any experience with. I'm the world's worst dancer, but I really found an appreciation for that kind of music and that art form. So, yeah, I think everything and nothing would be the short answer to what you asked. But the nice thing is I can actually appreciate everything, even if it's not something I would listen to. I think I've learned it. Once you kind of see behind the curtain on some of these kinds of music, you develop an appreciation for them and the art form, much more than just a general view.
Well, as an emerging professional who has seen behind the curtain by way of education and personal interests, what was one of your first or biggest aha moments? Like, oh, that's how they do this. Oh, this is that sound. Or, oh, that was easier than I thought. Do you have any of those experiences you can recall?
Yes. So what I find really interesting, and I think there's probably a sports analogy here, but you can have the most incredible, you can bring together the all-star team of all the best musicians in the world into a room, and then you can bring together a room of people that wouldn't have that same description, but have played together many, many times and are a team. And I've actually noticed that the sound that I grew up listening to was the teams, not the all-star group. And it's funny, I noticed that in sports, being I'm a big sports fan, and you can, put together this incredible offense, and they're not the same as the sum of their parts, either the best players or the second string players. It's the way everybody kind of works together and combines together. And from a musician standpoint, I think I was always drawn to that orchestral sound that complements each other, where not everybody is taking the lead. No, not everyone is the superstar. So yeah, it's interesting. And I actually think that's important in the collaboration on the film post side as well, that you bring together people that all have their roles and they can all have a say on, like, I get asked questions about editing and the editors will sometimes give me suggestions about music, and everyone kind of has their role to play, but everyone can give input and suggestions on other people's expertise. So yeah, it's funny that parallel.
Well, that's really great to hear, because I've spoken to directors who have a best idea wins mentality, which is, I would say, maybe converse to what you think of iconic directors of the 70s, maybe, or who became just so authoritarian or dictatorship-like. But, you know, if you listen to people who are smarter than you, I mean, it's the idea that smart people hire smarter people so that they can process their thoughts and opinions. And not to say everything needs to be a committee, but at least you're open to things that are outside your, you know, your mind and your purview. So, you know, so somebody needs to call you on your shit every now and then.
100%. And I've had a director say to me, you know, you have to be able to defend everything. So you shouldn't be insulted when someone asks you to defend it, because you will often realize if you can't defend it, that you need to, you know, take another look at it. It is definitely a tightrope, though, because when you get into filmmakers who outsource a lot of the decisions, you end up with a bit of a diffused focus in terms of the point of view of the film or the series or the story. So it's really a fine line. You want somebody who is an auteur who wants their interpretation and their vision, but you want them to be open to different ideas of how to express that.
Well, you know, this could be a whole nother conversation, and this is strictly just opinion. I wasn't not even a fly on the wall, but I wonder if somebody like Coppola, while making Megalopolis, or Wes Anderson, once they get to a certain point, I'm not saying that they were surrounded by yes men, but sometimes there might be that idea that you do need the dynamic flow or the reining in, or, you know, whatever movie is perceived as difficult to process, because, you know, there was obviously a creative struggle. So totally, totally different side point.
No, that's a really good point. And I think you're right. And I've worked with filmmakers who had too many people pressing them and too many obstacles to push against in terms of getting their vision. And then I've met the opposite, where they really needed someone to help them with their checks and balances so that they would be a little more focused in their choices. So the best you can do is try to do the same, I guess, in my line of work. And I'm lucky to have a great team of musicians and programmers and engineers and people that I work with that I really trust their feedback. And I actually, you know, I like, not always in the moment, but I like when they push back and say, hey, I don't know if you're doing this right. Because a lot of times they bring up ideas, or they give me a perspective that I wouldn't have thought of on my own. And I certainly recognize it makes the end product better to have that kind of oversight and have people feel comfortable to give that kind of input.
Well, I love the idea of defending your ideas. What over the years that I've been doing this, I've gleaned a lot of sound bites. So that's going in the can. It also sits next to, on the shelf, John Powell telling me part of a composer is just making a goddamn decision. And then Ilan Ishkari told me, he said, do your best, not shit. That's the MO for everything. So whether you have 2 weeks or 2 years. So,
well, I heard David Arnold, I don't know if you've ever spoken with him, but he was once quoted in an interview as saying his two favorite times of working on a score are the day he's hired and the day he hands it in. So I think about that a lot, because there's a whole lot of stress in between.
Yeah. Sounds like that boat analogy. Those are the two good, the, two best days of owning a boat is when you buy it, when you sell it. So that's
Right, that
great.
makes sense. That's funny.
Well, why don't we dive into TV shows? I think we should do a whole nother podcast on your films for Giant Geological Forces of Nature, aka The Rock, but we could do
Yeah.
that later. Topic du jour today is Landman, Taylor Sheridan. And I bring up Jablonski and Tyler at the beginning just as in jest. We love them. We've had them on the show a number of times, but I know that Brian Tyler has kind of been Taylor Sheridan's his go-to for the musical world, but you're just as competent, just as capable, just as bombastic. And so I'm listening to the Western vibe. I'm in Texas. I'm not too far from Midland or Odessa, and it just felt so close to home. I mean, some of it was shot in Fort Worth, but I'm three episodes in. Thank you to the screeners that I got. The music is really impacting, specifically with Billy Bob's monologue just before in the very first episode, after what happens happens, and it leads into the intro. It feels like that set the tone for the series. So when you work on something, do you find like a line in the sand? Do you find a scene or something, whether it's the director's idea, your idea, like do you say this is where I start from, or do you just write something so big that it kind of finds its way to fit the narrative?
So it's really cool that you picked that cue, because that is the cue and the scene that was the anchor for the whole 10 hours. I'm not kidding.
Okay, great.
So Taylor, I'm lucky. So I'm not part of the Yellowstone world. That is all Brian Tyler and Brett and Vivian, and amazing job they do on that. I met Taylor when he was making a show called Mayor of Kingstown with Jeremy Renner. And so that was my first thing working with him. And then he hired me to do Lioness, which is out right now, season two. And then Landman was the third thing we're doing together. So Landman, he's always extremely involved in the music. And we talk music before they've even shot a frame of picture, like before they've set up production, we're talking music. And he sends me the whole season of scripts. I read it all in one shot. And as you can imagine, in terms of binging a show from an amazing writer like Taylor, I literally read 10 hours in one shot. I cannot put it down. My wife will say, "Okay, time to go." And I'm like, "Nope, I'm only on episode seven." Like, I can't put it down. And it's so exciting for me to think, "Wow, I can't believe how lucky I am. I get to write the music for this." So, on Landman, it the other two shows, when we talked, we both had a very good sense of this is what the score should be. And on Landman, there was a lot more exploration and experimenting. And we kind of came, I don't know who what the where this quote's from, but you'll journey the world and come back to where you started, but see it for the first time. I'm butchering that quote, but
Still
basically
love it, by the
that.
way. Still love it, by the way. That's great.
Okay, so that's basically what we did. We started, we had this discussion early on and said, the score should sound like we were at a bonfire party and it's 2 in the morning and the party's died down and people have left or are sleeping on the grass. And the four people sitting around the bonfire are still up and having these incredibly deep conversations about what it means to be alive and about the universe. And they're staring at the stars. And if some person pulled out a guitar and started humming and plucking away, it wouldn't be perfect. It wouldn't be a performance, but it would be authentically real. And it would represent the most authentic, emotional human experience and interaction that we could think of. And there's no scene like that in the show at all. This is just sort of to get into this hypothetical scene, to get into this mindset. So we talked about that and kind of came full circle back to that. And it was a lot of experimenting with, more layers, more complex score. I've done a lot of big action movies where there's 500 moving parts at once, and this was the opposite of that. And Taylor, to his credit, I would send him a theme and he'd say, "What is that theme with one instrument? What is it slower? What is it with lots of pauses put in between?" So, We were still in this exploration mode that we had a pretty good idea that the theme was the theme, the opening title theme, but we were still playing around and brainstorming and throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks, which we often discuss. And he said, you know what, come down to Texas. And they were maybe a week into shooting. He said, come to set, let's sit and we'll talk in person. And I brought down some music, and we had a piano nearby that we could access. And it's funny, I just told Billy Bob Thornton this last week, but it was that scene. I was sitting in the tent outside, you know, right where he drives the truck into the, you know, into the horizon, and where he's just come out. I was sitting there the whole day, and I could hear him giving this monologue, and I recognized that there was a pitch and a melody to the way he delivers lines. And it was such a eureka moment where this light bulb went off and thought, holy crap, like Billy Bob is singing his lines almost instead of speaking them. And it's really subconscious, but I could then hear this is the key that this cue needs to be. This is the rhythm of what he is doing. And I came back to the studio the next week and wrote that cue and sent it in. And that's the cue that's there. And it really became an anchor for the show, both in theme and in style and in instrumentation. Like all of those instruments in that cue that you're talking about end up being used on their own in places or in smaller combinations, smaller ensembles. But yeah, that was a real key to the whole thing. And when you actually meet Billy Bob Thornton and you understand that he is a musician, like I think he was a musician before he was an actor. He's in a very successful band called the Boxmasters. He's the lead singer, songwriter. They have multiple albums, and it all kind of makes sense. You know, you kind of realize, oh, of course, like this isn't an accident that that it sounds like music.
Yeah, it just flows effervescently from him. No, that's great. And he really is, you know, I found myself captivated by his delivery and a lot of things he said, but just because, I mean, sometimes you meet a character for the first time and it's like an immediate attraction or you're gravitating towards. I mean, I think the last great TV character I just could not stop watching was Hugh Laurie in House. And while their deliveries are so different, it's kind of how impacting what they say. It's snappy. It sounds rehearsed. It feels lived in. I mean, there's I think it's episode 3 where he's talking to his daughter, and she goes, "How come you're so good at stuff?" And he goes, "Because I messed up a lot, and I remember my mistakes." And it's just like, holy cow! I mean, sure, that's his delivery. You still feel that's Taylor, you know, speaking, ventriloquizing, speaking on behalf of Billy Bob. But it's like, it's just so affecting. I guess that's where I'm getting at. And then the way you pair it with the music, it's like, sings.
You know, Taylor writes incredibly specific scripts. The dialogue, the set decorating, everything, the way shots are framed and the way the cinematography, everything is a recipe. There is no interpretation. It is very specific, to the point actually that when you read his script, you then, when you see the show edited and put together, you think, I've seen this before. Like, you literally think you've seen it before. Okay. Because the little movie you made in your mind when you read it is so exact to what he shoots. And he really captures Billy Bob's voice. Like, he wrote all of those lines in a way that I think Tommy's character, it just feels so organic and, you know, connected to how he delivers those lines. And I think, you know, in my experience, and this comes back to the music again and the idea of authenticity, some of the most authentic, real people I've ever met have been in Texas. What you see is what you get. What they say is what they mean. There is no posturing. There's no artifice. There's no wasting time. Somebody will say what they think. And I love that really all of the characters in this world follow that whole idea. And I think it was important And I actually think that was maybe a big reason why Taylor, his instincts were simpler, like no window dressing, no overproduction. And we even got to the point that, some of the mistakes, like I would be playing something and a string would ring strangely, or it would be slightly muted, and we kind of loved that. Like it just felt more human because of it. It was all the little things that make you human, in the music. So yeah, it definitely, had an impact in the way Billy Bob Thornton delivers those lines, throughout the season, not just that first cue, has such an impact on what the music is doing, how intimate it is, how much space you leave in between notes. I said to someone recently that I've never made so much noise on a piano with so few notes. And it's really, there's a lot of big chords that hang, and there's a lot of space. And almost to the point that some of the emotion in the music is actually the space between the notes and not the notes themselves.
Well, there are three specific cues I want to talk about. Now, I'm going to throw a lot at you, but in episode two, at the beginning, there's kind of a droning while the thing is happening to the pump. I don't want to spoil it. And it's kind of like it's, the ringing in the ear of Tommy's son, maybe intonating the blown eardrum that they say he had. Then there's a call between Monty and Tom at the Hotel Drover. And it's like a folkiness, but there's a lot of intensity to it. So I'll get to the third one. I want to know if you know what your mindset was to the droning and the phone call.
Yeah, it was, gosh, I think those were things I had written, and in both instances, and had sent them to Taylor and his editor, Chad Gallster, who's an incredibly musical voice as well, and a really important part of our process. And that was something he was drawn to in those scenes, and actually cut those scenes in parallel with the music. The piano to me kind of can work in two different ways. The piano can kind of feel like an upright piano in the corner of a saloon somewhere, where it's got this honky tonk kind of chorusy feel, slightly out of tune. And then it can also feel like this really upper society, elite instrument, where if you think back to Europe, and it was only the royals and the incredibly wealthy who were able to sit down and learn piano. So I thought of it in terms of its usage with the score as being needing to fit both worlds and being used kind of in both ways. Also, this is really silly, but Billy Bob loses a finger at one point. Sorry, spoiler alert, early on.
Pretty
And
shocking, but it's great how way he takes it. That just, his mentality in the hospital is just like, oh, you can't take your eyes off
exactly. And you know what? Those episodes have been released, so I can get away with saying that.
it.
But I did think about at one point, oh, what if there's one hand playing the piano and not two? What if I was trying to kind of find these little ways of metaphorically tying a hand behind the back, but in this case, literally, and in such a way that it would force me to do something different musically. And the droning is a combination of a few things. I have some different stringed instruments, and I have in my studio that I bow, like these really long, 7, 8 foot piano wires that are stretched over this wooden box. And then tuned, and I'll bow them with like a cello bow or a double bass bow and create these different overtones. Or I'll actually bow the piano strings. And then some of that was combined with this old harmonium, like a little pump organ, like they might have sold door to door 100 years ago. So yeah, those are two textures that I used in different ways in those two scenes. What's the third one?
Well, I'm glad you talked about the piano because I think the thing I really was taken to is Billy Bob's monologue about wind turbines, where and just the piano that's playing. There's just something equally magnetic about what he's saying, but also the score. And I'm just curious how that worked and what went into that cue specifically.
So much of the music is rubato, which is a musical term for almost without a metronome. It's not, you're not counting in your head or tapping your foot. It's sort of when you feel the phrase should start, you start it. The wind turbine scene, the early footage I saw of that, the whooshing of the blade going by kind of created this rhythm. And it influenced sort of the tempo that felt right to the scene. And the whole idea of the piano and the movement, there's more of a rhythmic structure to that scene. And it sort of felt like it was, I mean, I was thinking about the complexity and all the moving parts and in this energy infrastructure that he's talking about, both literally and metaphorically. All the things that have to fit together in terms of producing the electricity and then sending it through the power lines and it being consumed and not stored and distributed and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that was kind of the influence. And that's actually one of the places that the orchestra gets used. I mean, the strings, we recorded the strings at Abbey Road with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in London. And I remember them, somebody said to me, "This is it. These are the only notes we play." Like, it's really minimalist. And I kept saying, yeah, it's not how many notes you play, it's how you play them. But that is one of the cues where that sound and that instrumentation felt right, because it felt like it was, he's talking about the whole system and the whole world and energy infrastructure, both how we consume it, how we get it, what the politics are behind it. And it was much more of a puzzle of lots of interlocking pieces than the other cues in the show.
Well, that makes me think of, as a composer, you more than most people probably know what you want or where things going, yet you find yourself interfacing with clients or players who maybe understand the process but not see your vision. Have there been times, I mean, that was probably one of them, but what other times do you ever get in a situation where you're like, I've got bread, peanut butter and jelly. How in the hell are they going to go together? And then when you do it, like, this is the most delightful thing on the planet, like, and actually people come on board with your idea. You're like, I've been talking about that the whole time.
So that is the best part of my job, honestly, is having those eureka moments. And when, like, I've had directors say, "Oh, I'm going to leave you alone. I'm not going to give any input. I'm going to let you do the score." And that can be great, but to be honest, a better situation is when I go to a director and say, "Here's my idea," and they say, "Well, that's really interesting. Here's their idea." And then we go, "Wow, what if we put those together?" Or we together figure out a third idea that, is the equals part of the equation of our two ideas put together. And that's the best part. That's those moments when you go, "Wow, I came out of the room with something way better than I could have done on my own." And it's important to recognize that in what we do for a living, because it's not rare, but you want to look for those moments. Those are the kinds of people you want to continue to work with, because it's a really rewarding experience to do your best and then still to be able to look at the end result and feel really proud of it and feel like it was everyone contributing together.
Well, I love these creative insights because what you go back to talking about the Billy Bob's delivery influencing your scoring structure and the wind turbines helping influence the rhythm. I think that 99% of the people on the planet will probably never get or assume that. I mean, numbers might be off, but it's like that really just shows you how deep into the narrative you look, and that really makes these things unique. Because when I think of droning, I literally think of somebody hitting a piano key and going, but But there's more to it. There's subtlety, there's texture, there's rhythm, and so I mean, this is there's not a question there. That's just really fascinating to hear you explain all that.
Well, you know what? I'd love to say that it was all artistically driven. It's often music can have an incredible effect on drama. It can really elevate something, but it has the equal opportunity to destroy it. You can really ruin a performance with the wrong music. So a lot of decisions end up being not what should I do, but what shouldn't I do and what's left, And so much of, I think about this actually with actors, like how when they're delivering a scene, acting in a scene and delivering a line of dialogue, they are very measured in how vulnerable they want to seem, or how stoic, or how brave, or how cowardly. Like there's an equation that's going on in the way they deliver it. And the music could instantly, if just making up a scenario, but if there's a romantic situation between two characters, and they're being guarded, the music could completely ruin it by being overly sweet or overly guarded, or it can totally throw it off one side or the other. So a lot of times it's about finding, letting the performance kind of live by itself, and getting the music to tell another layer of it that isn't commenting on what the actor's doing, but just maybe creating context for what they're doing. So, and you mentioned earlier the Billy Bob scene with his daughter, and that's an example where the music is not scoring what he's saying, but the music is trying to create a poignancy to the conversation. Give it some gravitas, tell you that this is an authentic moment, and not try to reiterate what the dialogue is saying, but instead sort of parallel it on a different different layer, different level.
And that's kind of something that John Powell told me a long time ago when he's scoring animated films and properties, that a lot of times you're basically just repeating what's happening on screen. So you want to stay away from that because it's like there's no point to the music if I'm just pantomiming the what's happening. Again, a whole other conversation. But I think what you were saying actually kind of goes back to what we're saying earlier about no wrong notes. Even though you said you could spoil it with the wrong music. But my question to make this Landman related, in episode one, a character orders a latte, and that's considered a big no-no for obvious reasons that the show will let people know. So, what has been your ordering a latte moment like? Andrew, nobody told you don't do that? Or, holy crap, never gonna do that again. Lesson learned.
That is a good question. Well, I don't drink coffee or lattes. I make them for my wife. She loves coffee. Gosh, I think I've had a lot of those moments that, but I can't think of one in particular. I don't know if you're like this, but often I'll come back at the end of the day and go, "Oh man, I shouldn't have said that," or "I spoke too long about this." I'll probably say that about this podcast on some of my answers, but I've had many of those. By the way, there's no score in that scene, but that's one of my favorite scenes in that first episode. I think we've all been there. We've all had that moment. I love how Jacob plays that part.
It ain't about the taste, son. It's about the fuel. That's enough to get you going. Well, Mr. Lockington, this has been a pleasure. It looks like it's getting dark in Toronto, so I want to let you get ready for next week's Lions game. But before we truly head out, why don't we tell us Andrew Lockington's 10 favorite things? And I want to preface this with it could be anything. It could be a new shirt in a men's store. It could be turning on the cable and be like, I haven't seen Rocky III since I was 10, or whatever it is. What are your favorite things? There's no wrong answer.
Okay, 10. My gosh. Okay. I'll start from the top. Family, my wife, and I have three daughters. Dog is on there too. I have to put number six, what I do for a living, because I actually really love doing this for a living. I love football. I love hockey, not playing but watching. I love spending time with friends and real conversations, I have to say. Like friends where you can tell them anything and not worry about what their response will be. So, and then, yeah, warmth when I'm in the wrong place to have to say that, but I like living and being somewhere warm where the sun shines. So that's one of the 10 I need to work on for sure.
That was fantastic. And I think I can help you out with the 10th one. Next time you want to come to Texas, we'll do an interview in person, live, barbecue joint. There's a Billy Bob's in Fort Worth, not owned by not the Billy Bob, but it's a Billy Bob. So
I have been, I know that well, right near the Drover in
yeah,
that stretch
exactly.
there.
Exactly.
By the way, I love Texas. I feel very at home there. I love the people, and I will take you up on that invitation.
I can't wait. Press agents, take notes. We're gonna do it. All right, well, catch Lioness season 2, catch Landman, catch Mayor of Kingstown, all those seasons, catch Rock Extravaganzas 1, 2, 3, Rampage, the Step Up movies he was talking. I think he was talking about Step Up. But anyway, check out Andrew's work and he will not let you down. So until that time, we will catch you next time. Thanks, Andrew.
Awesome, Mark. Nice chatting. Thank you.